Reading this morning from Canto 1, Chapter 3, starting with texts, we cover three texts, 6, 7, and 8. These are, 6 is whether the list of incarnations, limited list, because one of the questions asked in Chapter 1 of Canto 1 was, the sages wanted to hear from Sutta about the forms of the Lord as they appear within this world. And so, he's describing, Sutta is describing. He discussed about the Purusha avatars, because those are also forms of the Lord, and they're also in this world, because the forms of the Lord exist transcendentally beyond this world, which is a very nice subject matter to contemplate. Forms of the Lord that exist beyond this world. So what exists beyond this world? Prabhupada would describe. In any religion, there is prayer to God. Very common sense, so that you're praying to someone you can't see, a bhokshaja. He's beyond your senses to perceive. But you're praying to him. The assumption is, he's a person. Because, otherwise, who's going to respond? Or what response will come from your prayer? It's a person. Well, because that even in your Oxford dictionary, you look up God, and what does it say? It says, the supreme being, even the dictionary confirms, person. But then, what is that person? Or, who is that person? And what are his qualities? And what is his form? And what are his means? And what does he do? And what's that kingdom of God? In the scriptures of the world, that information, that understanding is not conveyed. So, there's knowledge of the existence of God, but who is God, is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So forms of the Lord, who exist beyond this world, and those forms of the Lord as they appear within this world. So there's a prior assumption or understanding that the forms of the Lord are transcendental. But it's necessary to keep reminding ourselves of the fact over and over again, and over and over again, and over and over again, because the tendency is to think like us, because of this world means like us. But when the Lord appears in this world, it's not like us. Transcendental form. So the Purusha avatars are the first. And they're also, by ordinary senses at least, not visible. The yogis can see the form of Paramatma. And such vision of Paramatma is ecstatic. In Brihat Bhagavatamrita, which is now published by the DVT, written by Sanatana Goswami, he's describing life on the various regions of creation and even beyond creation. So he describes Tapaloka, which is above the heavenly region. So that there's 14 planetary systems. The bottom 7 are the hellish planets. Atala, Sutala, Rasatala, ta, kala, and so forth, going down. Going up, this bhoo mandala, this earthly region, is in the seven above, the lowest of the seven, or in the middle region. Then bhuvar loka, then svarga loka, otherwise known as heaven, svarga loka, where the devas reside, the realm of the devas, the heavenly realm. Still within the material creation, take note, in fact it's only three out of seven in the upper planetary systems. Heaven is not the ultimate destination. So above Svarga Loka is Jana Loka. Jana Loka is a place that's inhabited by grihastas who are perfectly detached from worldly thoughts. They have, attention, they have no material shelter. They have no material shelter. But they've not yet taken full shelter of the personality of Godhead. And their attraction is the performance of yajnas. So that's not common in this world. Persons who are attracted to yajna, but they have no material attraction. Usually it's yajnas to facilitate material attraction. No material attraction. And yet they're grihastas. But their interest is in the Lord of sacrifice. So it's described that in Janaloka, they like performing yajnas, because when they perform yajnas and invoke the Supreme Lord, when they pour oblations, what does it mean when we're pouring ghee into the fire?
This is for you.
Huh?
This offering for you.
Yeah. That fire is the tongue of the Supreme Lord, and we're offering grains and ghee to the tongue of the Supreme Lord. Svaha. So that, to a materialist, looks like a ritual. To a brahmana, it's approaching Brahman, the Supreme Brahman. And for the residents of Janaloka, the Supreme Lord appears with his arms extended to receive the offerings. And they see the Lord standing before them, accepting their offerings. So they like yajnas very much. As soon as one is over, they're preparing the next one. Because when the yajna is over, the Lord disappears. And they want to see the Lord. But so it's that's what happens in Janaloka. Above Janaloka is Mahar Loka. All that's described in Brihad Bhagavad Kamrata is that the end of each day of Brahma, he goes to death. So like the sun rises at whatever time it rises, depending upon the season. And it sets, so it ranges from 12 to 14 hours of sunlight, and then there's nighttime. But during the nighttime of Brahma, there's a partial devastation. And it's described this way, that there's a long period of drought, no rain. So no rain might be nice, but a long period of no rain is not nice. So everything becomes dry, dry, dry. And then fire. And everything ignites. In the lower planetary systems, the Bhuvar and Svargaloka regions, like where we are at the Brahma's night, is ashes. And in Janaloka, the fire doesn't reach, but it gets so hot. that they get in their vimanas, their airships, and travel to the next planetary region above, Maharloka, where it says that they stay for some time and then they come back to Janaloka after the heat's on. And that means the next day of Brahma, when he has to then he gets up in the morning and does his sadhana and he goes to the office. He recreates the lower planetary systems. Every day of Brahma. So then, Janaloka, Maharloka, Tapaloka. That's number 6 out of 7. In Tapaloka, the residents in Tapaloka engage in meditation. It's strictly lifelong celibates. So that puts a limit on who can go there. And the attraction in Tapaloka is not just meditation. People here also meditate, and sometimes they meditate on void, and sometimes they meditate on a candle, or a mandala, or a sound, or something to focus their mind. And the perfected yogis in this realm, they see the super soul. In Tapaloka, they are constantly engaged in seeing the form of the Lord within. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, the residents of Tapaloka include the rishis that are described in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. They're perfected Mahabhagavatas who were the sons of Rishabdev. You recall from the 5th canto of the Bhagavatam, Rishabdev had 100 sons. And the chief of those 100 sons was Bharata. But what about the other 99 sons? It describes in the canto. 9 of them were these rishis that are instructing Maharaj Nimi in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam. Tipalayan Rishi and so many rishis. So those rishis, there's been a number of them became kings and a number of them became brahmanas, which is nice evidence, Vedic evidence, that a father and mother may produce not just one social order or caste, but depending upon their propensity. Some became kings, some became brahmanas, some became sannyasis, some became perfected Mahabhagavatas. So, and when Gopal Kumar reaches Tapaloka, he also finds the 4 Kumaras. And that's the first of these incarnations that's mentioned here in chapter 3, the list of incarnations chapter. There's a similar list in Canto 2, just like listing, with a little incarnation. So the 4 Kumaras, they qualify, they're lifelong brahmacharis. And they like meditation. And later on in Srimad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopal Kumar reaches Vaikuntha, he's very surprised. He finds the same 4 brothers in Vaikuntha. And he says, didn't I see you somewhere? Yes, I remember. I saw you in Tapaloka. He said, oh, we just go there sometimes to encourage the meditators to fix their mind on the personality of Godhead. And one day then they'll come to this platform of devotional service. So they're actually The four Kumaras are residents of Vaikuntha. Now in text number 6, they're the first in the list of incarnations of the Lord. They're not Vishnu Tattva, they're Jiva Tattva. But there's a category of avatars called Shaktyavesha avatars, where a Jiva can bear or carry or be endowed with the full potency of the personality of Godhead in some category. And in the case of the four Kumaras, that's what they did. They were exhibiting the full potency of the Lord's Jnana Shakti. Jnana Shakti is the potency of knowledge. Now this is one of the six opulences of the personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. He possesses all knowledge. Could you imagine possessing all knowledge? It's inconceivable, isn't it? It's absolutely inconceivable. You can have knowledge of something, but to be able to, like, all knowledge, discuss this in today, it's like circuit overload. Where do you put all that information in the hard drive? It just doesn't fit. How many gigabytes of space do you need for all knowledge? But it's the potency of the personality of Godhead that enables a living entity or empowers a very, very qualified living entity, but still a living entity, tiny jiva, to bear all the potency of the Lord's knowledge. Only by empowerment. So, we certainly have experienced, even in our very, very limited lives, tiny living entities, of the Lord's endowing some potency upon living beings. For example, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, in his Chaitanya Charitamrita, he writes, Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Para Pravartana, which means that in order to bring someone to Krishna consciousness, one has to be directly empowered by Krishna. Now who here has had the experience of meeting somebody and they don't know about Krishna, and you begin explaining something about Krishna, and something happens and they become attracted to Krishna? We've probably all had such experience. According to Krishnadas Kaviraj, we should know that that's Krishna Shakti. It's Krishna's potency, it's not us. Basically, in order to help people come to Krishna consciousness, we have to do two things. Get out of the way, and let Krishna's message go through us. Now, some personal kindness and genuine concern for the individual, that's of course essential. But that alone doesn't bring people to Krishna consciousness. Often that may bring people to feel indebted if you did some kindness to them. But it doesn't bring people to Krishna consciousness unless there's Krishna's empowerment. Krishna Shakti Vina Nani Kara Pravartana. Even to bring one soul to Krishna consciousness, as it takes empowerment by Krishna. To induce someone to chant the holy name takes Krishna's empowerment. Because it's Krishna, it's not something material. So it takes Krishna's empowerment. So that's nice, isn't it? Become part of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan mission. Just go and on Harinam and chant. And you're receiving Krishna Shakti because others will also chant along with the chanters. Or take the message of Bhagavad Gita on book distribution and place that message in someone's hand. To do that requires Krishna's empowerment. We become empowered. Otherwise we can't. So directly we can experience that empowerment. So what to speak of? Then Gyan Shakti, the four Kumaras. So the appearance of the four Kumaras, I'll read what it says here. It comes, they appear shortly after the beginning of creation, at the dawn of civilization, as they say. Lord Brahma's first production, his praja. First of all, in the beginning of creation, there were four unmarried sons of Brahma, the Kumaras, who, being situated in a vow of celibacy, underwent severe austerities for realization of the absolute truth. Purport. The creation of the material world is effected, maintained, and then again annihilated at certain intervals. So, there are different names for the creations in terms of the different types of Brahma, the father of the living beings in the creation. The Kumaras, as above mentioned, appeared in the Kumara creation of the material world. So that's interesting. Prabhupada doesn't speak about this so much, but just as in different days of Brahma, different events, just like in different days of our life, different events unfold. Certain things are kind of standard. You get up, take a shower, and brush your teeth, and there's certain things that you do very routinely. So there's a certain spool, Prabhupada uses that word, like thread is wound around the spool, and certain events in regularity take place each day of Brahma. But there's some unique events that take place during each day of Brahma, as in our lives. And so the days of Brahma are identified according to those events. Similarly, the lifetime of Brahma, the creation, has some unique events each. Because Vedic time is cyclical, so creation, annihilation, destruction, resting, again creation, maintenance, destruction, the resting period, and then again. So there's, Prabhupada is using this language here in the purport, I'm assuming from our acharyas, that the Kumara creation, the four Kumaras are not in all universes or all creations of Brahma, it appears here, because it's specifically the Kumara creation is the creation in which the four Kumaras appear. And what is it the four Kumaras do? They teach us the process of Brahman realization. They undergo a severe type of disciplinary actions as bachelors, as celibate boys. These Kumaras are empowered incarnations, and before executing the severe type of disciplinary actions, all of them became qualified brahmanas. This example suggests that one must first acquire the qualification of a brahmana, not simply by birth, but also by quality, and then one can undergo the process of Brahman realization. What does Prabhupada want us to understand here? When you're reading Prabhupada's reports, this is a question you should be asking within yourself. Srila Prabhupada wants to guide us to the absolute truth, to Krishna. So he's writing, presenting in a certain way to help us reach that goal. And what's that message that he wants us to understand? If you want to reach the goal, you have to have some qualification. And the brahminical qualification is the qualification. And brahminical qualification does not depend upon birth. Brahminical qualification, as he said, is necessary. It's without exception. Just listening to Prabhupada explain this in a lecture in Los Angeles, where brahminical qualification is not to be found in this age of Kali. Even if one is born in a Brahmana family, saying the two paisa thread may be across their neck. But if their behaviors, if their qualities are different than the qualities of a Brahmana, then they're not Brahmana. Then we can say Brahma Bandhu or Kshatriya Bandhu or Vaishya Bandhu. But not Brahmana. So Brahmana, although the four Kumaras were born sons of Lord Brahma, they didn't start as Brahmanas. They developed the qualities of a Brahmana, and then they underwent the practice of trying to realize the personality of Godhead, or Brahman realization through their austerities. It doesn't detail what procedures they went through to develop those qualifications, which isn't so important. It's more important, what's our procedure? What's our procedure? Anybody want to volunteer? What's our procedure? We're being trained as Vaishnavas. So according to, there's a book this thick by Bhaktisiddhanta, so you can imagine. It's a heavy duty book. It's on this topic of Brahmanas, Brahmanism and Vaishnavism. It was a paper, a lecture that he had to deliver during a time of really heated controversy when he was about 30 years old. And they brought the problem to Bhaktivinoda Thakur to be like a referee to resolve a big wrangle between the Brahmanas and the Vaishnavas. So the wrangle had to do with who is superior, or stated differently, is it legitimate for a Vaishnava who is not born in a Brahmana family but becomes a Vaishnava, is it legitimate for a Vaishnava to perform Vedic sacrifices unless he's born in a Brahmana family? It's like all these, we would say nitpicky, they would say smart rules. You know, where you divide the blade of grass into how many little slices. Very, 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 very fine kinds of arguments. But they were a big hubbub about it. So, this, a very important part of this thick book that I'll just summarize is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said just what Prabhupada says here, that in order to become a Vaishnava, one must be a Brahmana by quality. Then he turned it around and said, but to become a Brahmana by quality, you must become a Vaishnava. So, because of this age, because in this age, persons don't have the qualities of a Brahmana, nor are there Brahmanas to train them how to become Brahmanas. There are persons that are born in families of Brahmanas, but they're not Brahmanas by quality. So how does one acquire quality? It's by these our process is these two things. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Sound vibration of the Lord's holy name cleansing the heart of the contaminations for years together inhabiting this material world. And the other is training. The persons that chant but don't receive training, or receive training but don't chant, it's incomplete. Specifically, the training is through instruction. I could give a practical example. Prabhupada had his disciples chant the holy name. But then when it came to cleanliness, we didn't have a clue of cleanliness. Not a clue. And he was appalled at our not having any sense of what was clean. You know, which hand you do which things with, and what is the standard? When you make a place clean, what's the standard of cleanliness? Hari Sori Prabhu, who was Prabhupada's servant for a long time, described his first experience of Prabhupada's training him in cleanliness. The training in cleanliness was any time you touched an opening of your body, your mouth or nose or ear or any of the other openings of the body, immediately you wash your hands or some of the openings of the body, immediately you take that. So when he was, I forget the detail now, but he was doing something in Prabhupada's service, and Prabhupada, he touched his mouth or something, and Prabhupada made a face, like, yuck. And Prabhupada raised his finger and said, go wash your hands. And then, so Hari Sori said, when Prabhupada, he saw it happen again and again over the years, and when first instructing, Prabhupada was very gentle, with the understanding that you didn't know, and now you know. But if it happened a second time, Prabhupada wasn't gentle. Prabhupada was very firm. And his voice would raise. And when he was really, like, three times, four times, he said his lips would tremble. And voice would raise further. And Hari Sori said he was in tears. He said, Prabhupada, just this lecture, I don't have any sense of cleanliness, I'm hopeless. I think you should throw me away. Because the standard of cleanliness that Prabhupada expected, like, you know, this I heard from Hari Kesh, that Prabhupada would not eat in the same room as he would do other things. You would not allow people to bring prasadam. This is the standard of cleanliness that Prabhupada came. You know, we do this all the time. You know, we're hanging out together and bring prasadam and hang out and take prasadam. Prabhupada wouldn't do that. You take prasadam in a separate room, clean it thoroughly, and then you go to, you know, continue your work in another space. And so he said, you Westerners are hopeless. But no, his standard of cleanliness was summit cleanliness, and he meant it. Not like wherever there's some obsessive, compulsive cleanliness person. Prabhupada was just, that was the standard of cleanliness. And so forth. So without training on cleanliness, or just, you know, things of Vaishnava etiquette. How do we know how to behave? Then how do we instruct others in Vaishnava etiquette? Supposing we know some item of Vaishnava etiquette, then what do we do? Not Vaishnava etiquette, we take that information like a stick and go chasing after people. That's not Vaishnava etiquette. That's abusive. So, how do we instill Vaishnava etiquette in an individual or a group of individuals? It takes all of this takes training. We're all chanting, but it also takes training to become qualified. So our process is the elevator process, right? It's not the stairway process, it's the elevator process. We chant and engage in devotional service. And we're with Krishna. Because Krishna is not different than devotional service and is all we need. So the other side must be there. There also must be standards of cleanliness. Just like, you know, what goes on in the pujari room and on the altar is for brahmanas. And if the brahmanas don't know what the standard of cleanliness is, that's a big problem. Then who is? I'll just a little inside news report. In North America, we invited the minister of deity worship, whose name is Srinath Kavachak Das, who received his training in deity worship under Janadivas and Pankajamri. He sees them as his deity worship gurus. We invited him to North America to review the standards of worship of all the temples that have Radha Krishna deities. And next year, wherever there aren't Radha Krishna deities, but perhaps Jagannath or Gaurasai deities. And would you care to guess what he found was the weakest part of overall in all the deity worship? Cleanliness. And you know what are the two most important items in deity worship that Prabhupada stated? Cleanliness and punctuality. So if something's missing, we're chanting, I'll assume the pujaris in North America are chanting. They're chanting. But cleanliness standard is down. But needs to be up. Because that's a brahminical quality. And deity worship is to assist us in coming to that high grade quality of being so dear to Krishna, so near and so dear to Krishna as a pujari. Clean, summit, clean. Like a little item, I don't know if you have this practice here, but it's just a little item that after every arti, you clean. You get the wet damp cloth, make the whole floor, the table, the legs of the table, the place where everything is made clean. Every time there's an offering. It's not like Krishna, you know, slobbered all over the table or something. It's just a principle of cleanliness. It's a principle of cleanliness. Summit cleanliness. And keeping, I don't want to go into too detail, but keeping the srinasan above the deity, very clean. All the utensils, very clean. The place where the utensils are kept, the drawers and shelves, very clean. Very clean. That's what it means to be a Vaishnava Brahman, engaged in deity worship or engaged in preaching. I can, just a comment, just like this little class that you were conducting this morning with the children. My sense is that the people of this country are very simple. And if someone is factually in the quality of a Vaishnava Brahmana and performs such functions as reciting the scriptures, people will come. Where there's purity, there's actual Vaishnava Brahmana quality, people will come. They'll come and they'll learn and they'll become attached to Krishna. Because the Brahmana, Vaishnava Brahmanas, they may not become Brahmanas, but they will become attached to Krishna through the Vaishnava Brahmana. So the Vaishnava Brahmana has to have that quality in addition to, we want them to chant, and because in any way can chant. But we want them to become attracted to Krishna, so some training is also required of them, that the person's training have to be gentle, Brahmanas, and qualified. if Krishna, to spread Krishna consciousness further in this country, I would say the formula is simple. Just become Vaishnava Brahmanas, and you'll spread Krishna consciousness in this country. You'll do the things that Vaishnava Brahmanas do. We do it to the right standard. Now, we don't necessarily expect that all people are going to have that standard of cleanliness as the Vaishnava Brahmanas have on the altar in their homes. But we should maintain that standard and be of that dearness to Krishna. Nearness and dearness to Krishna. So, the four Kumaras were showing that example. They were sons of Brahma. Hey, sons of Brahma. But they got training to become Brahmanas, and then they underwent severe austerity in order to realize the absolute truth, according to this explanation that's presented here. And because of those two qualifications, when they came before the gatekeepers of Vaikuntha, and they were even outside Vaikuntha, but they smelled the fragrance of the tulsi and sandalwood paste offered at the lotus feet of the Lord. And just that, by this sense of smell, they became attracted to the personality content instead of to impersonal Brahman. That's how subtle and purified they were. So we have this, you know, the offering of flowers and a little Q-tip, attar, that's been dipped in fragrant oils and offered to the deity. And we smell, and we're not, same thing isn't happening. So what does that mean? The potency is the same, but it's not happening with us. What does that mean? We need to follow the example of the four Kumaras and really concentrate on purifying ourselves so that when we chant the holy name or smell the flowers offered to the deity or see the deity form of the Lord or any of those impetuses for ecstatic love for Krishna, the heart turns, the heart changes. So, I thought I was going to get further than I'm going to get, but I think I'll end with this. There's not disqualification. We're not ineligible for going back to Godhead, being with Krishna by birth. We have this elevator method, we just chant Hare Krishna, engage in service, and voila, we're devotees. But on the other hand, the training is necessary. The develop the culturing of the qualities of purity is essential. Otherwise, these highly potent activities can take a very long time, longer than we would want. We have to strive to become qualified while we're and receive proper training. How to become qualified Vaishnava Brahmanas. And then, whatever it is that we do, we'll have great spiritual potency. One whose heart is pure, when they speak, I was sharing this with one end with this example. There's a disciple of Bhakti Tirtha Swami. I don't know if any of you ever visited Valachua. Her name is Indrani. She's really old. She's in her 70s. Her body is now getting quite infirm. And I've known her for, I don't know, at least 12 years, maybe 15 years. And always she was there with her ears like this, hearing. Very, very eager to hear. And very sincere woman. Now, she's elder. So, but she's not just elder. So when people hear from elders, they may or may not listen. But when she speaks, everybody listens. She doesn't speak a lot. But when she speaks, everybody listens because she's very pure. She doesn't have to say a whole bunch of things. She's a powerful woman because she's very pure. So I was appreciating that quality that she has, the quality of purity, the quality of how strong she is. She doesn't speak hard, she just speaks straight. And she was sharing with me how much it pains her when she sees her godbrothers and godsisters as Bhakti Tirthaswami's disciples getting in little tiffs with one another. And, you know, he's not there. Our spiritual father isn't there to settle the family squabbles. It pains her very much. I said, Mother Indrani, you have such purity and such love for your spiritual master. If you can speak words that bring the devotees together, they'll move and come to a standard that you know he wanted. You just speak those words. And it's very powerful because purity is the force. Exchange with her, there were some things that she had said during Bhakti Tirthaswami's Pushpa Samadhi ceremony. She spoke publicly and had everybody in tears. She's such a powerful person. Simple, little tiny, you know, trembling because her body is so frail, kind of frame. Very, very powerful. Purity is the force. And if we can somehow connect with purity in within ourselves, individually and collectively, Krishna consciousness movement will really impact the lives of people in general, whatever interactions we have with them. Any discussion? Question?
No, Maharishi, you mentioned when we have to update the plan. So if we have to look forward in a situation where we have to not update
the plan. Wait a minute, there was a cough right in the middle. We have to do service in what circumstance?
If we have to look forward to the deities in a better situation, in a situation where the sentiment is not updated,
update
our
content.
And we make comments about it, and we
make it
famous, or get
even
worse. So, what should we do?
Well, making comments about it doesn't help. You set an example. What's the example? You just make the place clean. And how many times does it take to make the place clean? As many times as it takes to make the place clean. That's true for, aside from, you know, deity service, it's true for any service. Kitchen service or preaching. How many times have I had to say the same thing to certain people? It's so obvious. No, I could just get frustrated and say, oh, the heck with it. Or you're useless. As many times as it takes. At least, I mean, it should not be in, I'm going to show them, but it should be in the mood of service. In the mood of service, says, oh, this needs to be cleaned. Krishna's giving me some other community for service. Now when the mood, when there's cleanliness and more of it and more of it, then, you know, just like an example, after the Sunday feast in Kring, there were paper plates and cups and yuck all over the place. But I went and picked them up the next morning. So people get used to seeing me clean. Now some people, they're just, their habits are not clean. So we want to speak the message to help people's habits become clean. We don't speak down to them. Like, what's wrong with you people? You're dirty. You don't take your persona and when you're done, just chuck it. Any old place. Or off to the side at least. No. But that takes training. So we're all part of the process. But you could, for example, go and speak to the person in charge of the jar room. And you get an earful. Probably like, do you know how many times I make this place clean? And do you know how many people come in here and just make a mess? Now, they'll share with you their frustration. So, it's, you know, somebody's not keeping it clean. So we're all responsible. So one, you know, then they, some places they lock the pujari door, pujari room door. Only brahmanas, or people that are trained to keep the place clean. And then after some time, that standard slackens. So to maintain standards, it takes the mode of goodness. You don't get to the mode of goodness by passion. You get to the mode of goodness by goodness. And when the darkness, can collectively develop a nice service mood together, then you can maintain nice standards. And then, you know, we're a preaching movement, so there's always new people that come in and mess up those standards. I mean, they have a lower standard. So we don't yell at them, or we don't seek them out. We're patient to maintain high standards and train them to come gradually to higher standards. But at least those that are very closely connected to the temple need to know what standards are, and they need to maintain standards and work cooperatively together to maintain those standards and not, you know, have friction with one another over what the standards are. They just work cooperatively to maintain standards. Because, you know, sometimes I may be the person that leaves something in a wrong place. Well, another time I'm picking up after somebody who left something in the wrong place. Yes.
On the same question, the Brahminical standard that you were speaking is like an absolute standard to make that. I remember we were working on this, and one of the conclusion of the whole discussion was that if we keep the standards too high, right, then people will not be attracted to the service. So we have to keep the standards average to meet. You know, people will let, in this way, the service go on. And this was the conclusion. In this way, I can understand why maybe she's a little frustrated, because do the right thing and keep the standard high, but then another group comes in and then they want the standard high.
from the authority that people like this lead everyone.
But just like consciousness, if you settle for mediocre consciousness, it becomes low consciousness very quickly. We should always be striving. So whatever this, Prabhupada gave us a standard. I say whatever Prabhupada gave us as a standard, we maintain that standard. We strive to go beyond that standard, but we maintain the standard. Because as soon as you relax and say, well, we can't maintain that standard. Right, the standard that when you have Radha Krishna deities, only brahminical initiated devotees should cook or should touch the fire and others can assist. Then Prabhupada made the exception. That's the standard. And then, this could be a long discussion over detail. Detail is not the essence. So he said, well, in that case, then initiated devotees can touch the fire. But you should strive for the condition where brahminical initiated devotees only are touching the fire. And that's not a new, that's an age-old standard. So I'd like to modify your statement with however long the discussion took. The conclusion should be, you should know what the standard is. Here's what we did in Chicago. There was the head pujari had a heart problem. So she was very concerned what the standard was that she had been trained. And so we invited Krishna Kshetra to come and wrote, this is the standard. Now we're going to allow a decreasing of the standard because the head pujari has a heart problem and other persons are going to come in. And now it's written what the standard is. We're going to drop down, but we want to get back up. And we're going to keep this document there so we know what that standard is or was. And what the exception is an exception. We want to go to that standard. But we're striving for that standard. Once again. You lose that striving and you lose your Krishna consciousness. Everything goes down. Standards go down, consciousness goes down, enthusiasm goes down, and you get all the other unwanted stuff like quarreling, Kali-yuga, in days, like anything. You spend all your energy resolving quarrels instead of your energy bringing the standard up. Accepting we're not able to maintain, that's all right. By Prabhupada's example, it's all right. We should know what the standard is and strive for the standard.
And you're saying that we should get out of the way and the Krishna.
Get out of the way means false ego. Stop acting through false ego. And I say get out of the way, that's what it means. Rather than acting through false ego, we act in the mood of service. Let's get out of the way.
Doesn't it also mean that we act to purify ourselves and once we receive our purification and our desire to change
our mind? Sure, but that's part of get out of the way. It's this false ego, the contaminations. That the self-conceptions that materialistic life deeply embeds in us, and we have a tendency to bring that into the beginning stages of our devotional service. At least the beginning stages, and sometimes, we never get our stuff out of the way. Contaminations are hard.
How do we deal with that?
How do we do what?
How do we best deal with that? the false ego that is the earth.
In our own false ego, yes?
Yes.
Recognize that it's there and take the position of the humble servant of Guru and Krishna and cultivate and cultivate and cultivate the humble mood of service to Guru and Krishna. And that, I teach that all the time, I mean, all the time. And it takes a long, long time for people to get it. But when they get it, it's just a little ray of light, but that little ray of light makes it such a difference. Whatever it is that we do should be in the humble mood of service. Because that's who we are. We're constitutional servants, and so we should go forward, staying always in that mood of connected to those who we're serving as we're serving. Always in that humble mood. I'll just point of application. Yesterday morning before Guru Puja, there was a question one of the devotees came up and asked and said, you know, during the lecture you had mentioned something about the spiritual master accepting disciples on behalf of the civil succession in Krishna. So who is the deliverer? Is the spiritual master the deliverer, or is Krishna the deliverer? I said, the function you take full responsibility for, and while you're taking full responsibility for it, who is doing it? Krishna. How could a servant think otherwise? A servant can't think otherwise. But in false ego, one thinks otherwise. I'm doing it. I'm doing the RT. I'm running the temple. I'm selling the book. I'm chanting the kirtan. I'm giving the class. I'm initiating disciples. I'm any service. The servant is thinking, I take full responsibility that this is done nicely on behalf of the master, my spiritual master and Krishna. And the servant can't think otherwise. Krishna is the deliverer. Krishna is the worship, you know, it's the medium of devotional service is just a way to offer back to Krishna what is Krishna's. It's Krishna's internal potency. We're just being carried as a cooperator with Krishna's internal potency. And thinking otherwise is false ego. Kartha hami ki manyate.
It's wrong for the disciple to think that I'm here directly
to
Krishna.
Yes, it's wrong for the disciple to think like that. So then what is this? What is the disciple hearing? He's hearing Krishna speaking through this person. I mean, it's a very strong impression in my formative Krishna conscious life was having Prabhupada enter a state of samadhi right before us in Mayapur, speaking on this point. It made a strong impression in my young spiritual life. He was saying when the spiritual master says, surrender unto Krishna. When Krishna says, surrender unto Krishna, surrender unto me. And the spiritual master says, surrender unto Krishna. The speaking is not different. It's Krishna speaking. Then he said it again, and then he said it again. And he didn't get very far after that. He went into a trance. But what was Prabhupada wanting us to understand? It's just a lecture I was listening to. The Mayavadis say the spiritual master and God are non-different, which is true. So I become a spiritual master, I become God. That's false. There's the servitor Godhead and the master of the servitor Godhead. And that's true. So the servant can't think other than being a servant. So how does the one who is receiving, if a disciple, think? I worship him as good as God. But he's not God. It takes some maturity to have the proper understanding. Not a human, not an ordinary being, you should say. But not God either. But not, you know, the representative of God. He is to be worshipped in that way. The message of God is coming in an unchanged fashion. God is speaking through this person. And the message is for me. It's very personal. But it's not just take it away from that particular function. And any service that we do, say, we go in Harinam, or we go in food distribution, or we go conduct a program, or we go cook an offering, or we do an RT, or we make a garland, or we, you know, whatever it is that we do. It's the internal potency of the Supreme Lord. And that internal potency is connecting us with Krishna. It's a great fortune. The false ego says, I'm going to do it. It's missing all of the essence of bhakti. Yes, we take responsibility. That was this discussion with this other devotee yesterday. Spiritual master takes full responsibility. It's like, you know, mother and father begetting a child. It's to take full responsibility. Oh, it's just Krishna. Krishna will take care. Take full responsibility. But what's the capacity to take that child to the spiritual world? It's their responsibility, but the deliverer is Krishna. So they do everything in the proper way to their fullest capacity. Fully depending upon Krishna. That's our life and devotion to Krishna. Okay.
Can Pupala Daya use in the service of Krishna Narayana?
I can't understand.
He said if Pupala Daya could be used in the service of Rasa.
Sure, sure. Not for cooking. You know, cook with coconut oil. We can do some things with coconut oil, yes.
I was just thinking about the last 5 years. The Sun takes responsibility.
Sure.
I'm going to be responsible for it. But you know, Krishna knows.
That's right.
But does the person make the choice?
Of course.
Well, yes.
There's free will in every second. Now we're choosing, you know, you're chanting. You're making a choice to chant. You're also making a choice how attentive you're going to be when you're chanting. We're making constant choices. It's surrender to Krishna. That's credit. Come on. We're not impersonalists. We're not impersonalists. Krishna's doing everything. I'll just sit in the hammock, sip lemonade, rub my head with coconut oil. No.
So the devotee gets the credit.
Yes, the credit is his surrender. And he's giving all credit to Krishna. And Krishna's giving all credit to him. The example, the devotee got it when I gave the example of Krishna showing Krishna and Arjuna. Who killed the other side? Krishna. He showed in the universal form. But he wanted to give Arjuna the credit. So Arjuna gets the credit. Because Krishna wanted to give him the credit. Krishna is the deliverer. Krishna is he's the ultimate doer. And somebody gets credit. There's five factors to act in. One is the endeavor. We get some credit for the endeavor. You get some surrender credit. But the surrender devotee gives all credit to Krishna. Because he knows the potency is from Krishna. So I'll take the instrument credit. Okay.
When a couple was in there,
Like, you know, that the paintbrush, that the paints a beautiful painting. I'll take the credit out on the paintbrush. Yeah, I was a good paintbrush. I just cooperated with the artist. Yeah, that's credit. That's credit. Devotee gets credit. The devotees appreciate other devotees for their how much Krishna, just like Sanatana Goswami was appreciated by Haridas Thakur. How much Lord Chaitanya loves you. He put you in this difficulty, this red itches and tribulation and ordeal and this and that, and then he took it all away. He just wanted to make you more attached and completely dependent upon him, how much he loved you. And Sanatana Goswami turned around and said to Haridas Thakur, you are the greatest recipient of Lord Chaitanya's mercy. Proof is, you know, he's giving him the credit. You have perfect prachar and perfect prachar. You're the greatest recipient of Lord Chaitanya's mercy. Okay? He gets credit. But ask Haridas Thakur. I'm the most fallen, lowly, lowborn, despicable. But Lord Chaitanya is most fine. Patita Bhavana. Srila Prabhupada, please.